Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's April 6th, our first meeting after spring break, but you probably already had a lot of classes already yesterday and this morning. So welcome back to campus, and we're going to start muscle physiology today. And don't forget, what is happening next week on Tuesday? Exam 3, and I believe that's chapters 9, 10, and 11, which is autonomic nervous system, sensory, and endocrinology. Those are the chapters on the test, okay? All right, so we're all kind of on the same page right there. Muscle. All right, so how many different kinds of tissues are in the body? Four. There's four kinds, and what are they? What are the four kinds of tissues? Nervous tissues, one. We spent a lot of time on nervous tissues in here. Oh, okay. Well, nervous is a kind of tissue for sure. We're good. We're good with that. But we got three more. Connective. All right, half done. So we got nervous and connective tissue. What else is there? Epithelium. That's a third kind. And the fourth kind is? Muscle. Thank you. I don't know why you remember that one last, since that's what we're going to talk about today. All right. So what is muscle specialized to do? Yeah, to contract. It shortens. You're going to see that it has a lot of properties that are similar to neurons. What's a special kind of membrane protein that makes an axon really special, an axon of a neuron? What kind of special protein does it have that allows it to conduct action potentials, for instance, as a hint? What kind of membrane protein does an axon have? How about a voltage-gated channel? Is that ringing a bell? Maybe. Okay. All right. Now, what kind of special membrane proteins does a dendrite or cell body have? It has an ion is a charged particle, yeah. But it has what? A ligand-gated channel, right? And channels just allow ions to move across the membrane. And when it does, it changes the membrane potential, right? Changes the electrical properties of the cell, and that might change some of the metabolic properties of the cell. And so it can be used to transmit information or regulate things inside the cell. Okay. So we're going to see that that's one important feature that muscles have or share in common with neurons. So don't forget about your neurons, because it's very important to understand muscles as well. Okay. And we did talk about what is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells called?
Synapse.
A synapse. It's another important model that I don't want you to forget about. And remember, there's two kinds of synapses. What are the two kinds of synapses? Chemical and electrical, and we're going to look at the junction between a neuron and a muscle, and that's going to be a special case of a chemical synapse. But you should employ all of your knowledge of a chemical synapse to understand that. All right, so that's just a little brief introduction, but don't forget your anatomy on muscles. All right, so again, we just said that a muscle is specialized to contract, and so a muscle will shorten. What's attached to a muscle? What attaches to a muscle that a muscle pulls on? Bone, right? For instance, usually a muscle is attached to two different bones. When a muscle contracts, it pulls two bones together. That causes motion in your body through some kind of articulation. Or there's a few muscles that are attached to skin, okay? Maybe like for raising your eyebrows or winking your eye or moving your lips around or something like that. But most are connected to bones. Via what kind of tissue?
Tendon.
Yeah, that's a tendon, and that's a connective tissue. So here we see tendon connecting muscle to bone. When this apparatus here contracts, it pulls this bone. Now, on a muscle, it has two ends. So it's usually connected, in the simplest situation, to two different bones. Now, do both of those bones move the same degree, the same amount, typically? No. Okay, what do you call the end of the muscle that's producing the most motion, that's moving a bone the most? What's that called? You can't remember that. Okay, well, I'm glad we're just reviewing. That's called the insertion. Does that ring a bell? Okay. And what is the end of the muscle that doesn't really cause a bone to move, but it's the more stationary end of the muscle? It kind of anchors them. That is the origin, right? Okay. All right, so I do want you to be able to conjure some of this information back up. And if you need to go back to your anatomy book, go ahead, go back and read a little bit that introductory chapter on muscle. All right, and the connective tissues that pull on this tendon right here are the connective tissue sheaths around the various components that we have inside of a muscle. So here we see a whole muscle, maybe like the coracobrachialis or brachialis or biceps brachii. That's an organ because it has muscle tissue, has nerve tissue, it has blood, right? It has many different kinds of tissue, so indeed it is an organ. And there's a connective tissue sheath around the whole muscle organ that we call the epimysium, right? And that is continuous with the tendon, so that when this muscle contracts, it pulls on the epimysium, that pulls on the tendon, which then pulls on the bone. Good. All right, so if we look at this whole muscle organ, we see that it actually has some fine structure associated with it, and we see these different packets of material right here. And sometimes we call them bundles, but the more appropriate term was going to be what? What would we call these bundles right here? These are fascicles, right? So these are fascicles, and even inside of a fascicle, we see some structures, and those are the individual muscle cells. So furthermore, when a muscle contracts, it's going to pull on this connective tissue sheath around a whole fascicle. Okay, and what the heck do we call that connective tissue sheath? That is the perimysium. All right, that's continuous with the epimysium, which is continuous with the tendon, which then eventually pulls on the bone. All right, but if we look at a fascicle, we see even more fine structure. What do we see inside of a fascicle? We see individual muscle cells, and a name for a muscle cell is a muscle fiber, and it's named after the structure of a muscle cell. It's very long and narrow, right? And this is a skeletal muscle cell, and from your knowledge, is a skeletal muscle cell branched, or is it linear? It's linear. It is not branched. It's just a long, long cell. And that's because at some point in development, each muscle fiber was maybe 1,000 or more individual muscle cells that fused together to make this one really big long fiber, which today really is a cell. So if we look at a muscle fiber, how many nuclei do we see in there? Many, 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 because at one point in time it was many, many individual muscle cells, progenitor cells, okay, that fused together. And indeed, there's a connective tissue sheath around every muscle cell or muscle fiber, and that's what we call the endomysium. And the endomysium connects up with the perimysium, which connects up with the epimysium, which connects to the tendon right here, which means that this whole thing pulls together, which pulls on this insertion on this bone right here. All right, but guess what? We're still not done. Because if we pull out an individual muscle fiber or individual muscle cell, even though we see that it has many nuclei in there, but at least now you know where all these nuclei come from, there is even more fine structure. We see even some more tubes inside each individual muscle cell. All right, and these are the organelles of contraction. So we're kind of getting down to the nitty-gritty right here in terms of how a muscle fiber actually contracts. And these little organelles are called? That's pretty close. They're made up of sarcomeres. But each one of these long tubes, see, here's a long tube, and so here's a sarcomere from here to here, and there's another one from here to here, each within this one single tube, and it goes on for miles and miles and miles. Not quite. It's microscopic, of course, but it's a very long structure. It's an organelle. It's the organelle for contraction. What is that thing called? We see many, many of them in this muscle fiber right here, or muscle cell. That's what we call a myofibril. Myofibril is like an organelle. Give me a name of another organelle that you know about that has some kind of function. Mitochondria, what does it do? Produces copious amounts of ATP if there's oxygen present and there's glucose present, right? Okay. But a myofibril's function is not to make ATP, it is to shorten or contract. All right, and this particular muscle cell has, oh, I guess we could count them up. How many do you see right there? 10 or 15 of them? Not too important, but we see a number of myofibrils. And guess what? We're still not done. If we look inside each of these myofibrils, there are structures inside the myofibrils, and now we're at a submicroscopic level, right? These are actually protein molecules that we see. But you can see that they're long and narrow as well. They kind of look like fibers, but they're teeny tiny fibers. All right, we don't call them tiny tiny fibers, we call them filaments. All right, so these are filaments that make up the myofibril. So you got to become really familiar with this hierarchical structural organization of contraction. All right, so what's the biggest unit that we see right here? We see, the organ, a muscle, which is an organ. And it can be broken down into fascicles. Fascicles can be broken down into cells, right? Cells can be broken down into myofibrils. And then the basic building block of these myofibrils are these filaments, and sometimes we call these myofilaments, right? So make sure you know the building blocks of muscle. Starting at maybe this protein level, submicroscopic level, moving all the way up to the organ level, or starting at the organ level and understanding the basic building blocks, moving all the way down to these proteins right here. And you should probably be aware of these different connective tissue sheaths around these different elements that make up a muscle organ. Okay. The cell membrane around a muscle fiber is called the sarcolemma. So anytime you hear this term sarco, what kind of image should you have in your mind? Yeah, you might want to even have like a video, contraction. Because what's that? That's a muscle of some kind, right? So sarco has something to do with contraction. All right, and if we look at a skeletal muscle cell underneath a microscope, so here's a pretty nice micrograph, we see that there's a very characteristic pattern that is evident. And what do we call this pattern? Striations, right? So the zebra stripe is very characteristic of skeletal muscle as well as cardiac muscle. All right, so cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle has, at least at this microscopic level, some similarity. So what can you tell me about cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle? If they sort of look the same, what does that mean? If they sort of have the same structure, at least on some level, what can you tell me about the function? The function is going to be somewhat similar, okay? So when we get to the cardiovascular chapter, we'll improve upon that concept. Okay, so one of the characteristics of muscle, besides its being able to contract, is that it is excitable. It can stay in an unexcited state, or it can be prodded into doing something, which would be contraction. And what causes contraction is a signal, a control signal from a motor neuron right here. So here we see an axon. What is going to be coming down this axon right here? Action potential. And I see a nice Schwann cell right here, so that action potential is actually going to hop down this axon to get to this muscle fiber. So here's an individual muscle fiber. So here's the sarcolemma. All right, now what are all of these structures? Those are the organelles of contraction, or myofibrils, right? So here are numerous myofibrils right here. All right, and so here is the junction between this motor neuron and the muscle fiber, right? So that's a synapse, and it's a chemical synapse. So what does that mean? Tell me something, what does that mean in terms of communication? What's happening at this chemical synapse? Yeah, this neuron has to release a neurotransmitter, which diffuses across the synaptic cleft and has to interact with the sarcolemma of this muscle fiber cell. And typically, what do you know about that interaction? What does, for instance, this like this postsynaptic cell, the muscle fiber, what does it have in order to respond to that neurotransmitter? It's got to have a receptor. And in particular, it's a nicotinic type acetylcholine receptor, where two acetylcholine molecules have to bind to it. That opens up a sodium channel. And then what happens to the membrane potential at this synapse right here? It depolarizes, which is typically what we consider what kind of signal? Excitatory or inhibitory? It's an excitatory signal on this muscle cell right here. Well, we typically don't call this a synapse because when the muscle is stimulated or excited, all right, guess what it does? it jumps around. It moves around a lot, and it can pull away from this neuron right here. But this is a special kind of synapse that we call the neuromuscular junction. So there are special protein elements underneath the neuromuscular junction that glues this axon to this particular location of the muscle, so that when the muscle moves around, it can't pull away from the neuron. It goes for a ride with the muscle when it contracts. So that's really the biggest, one of the biggest differences of the neuromuscular junction and a typical neuron-neuron synapse. Okay? Because the neuron is glued effectively to the muscle fiber right here. And so there is additional specialization of proteins at the neuromuscular junction. We call this the motor end plate. So that's a little bit different than a typical kind of synapse. So we see more structure, we see more folds in the sarcolemma, but everything else that you know about a synapse pretty much works at this level, at least a nicotinic type system, or what do we call a system that works with acetylcholine? It's a cholinergic, yeah, so this is a nice cholinergic system of a nicotinic type. Okay, and here you can see a nice micrograph that shows a myelinated neuron coming down to this one muscle fiber right here, and this is the neuromuscular junction with the motor end plate underneath it. Okay. Okay, so this is a review of a concept from anatomy as well. A muscle fiber that we see right here, we see a number of muscle fibers. A number of them can be innervated by one motor neuron. So in this particular case, we see one motor neuron innervating how many muscle fibers? Three, right? So when there's an action potential that comes down this axon, right, guess how many fibers contract within this whole muscle right here? Just three fibers contract. These neighboring fibers do not contract because there is no synapse between them. There is no chemical synapse, there is no electrical synapse between them. So this is what we call a motor unit, a single motor neuron and all of the individual muscle fibers that it innervates. All right, so you can imagine how muscles contraction is controlled. When a muscle fiber is told to contract, when an action potential reaches the neuromuscular junction, the muscle fiber can never make up its own mind, can never make a decision whether it's going to contract or not. It just automatically contracts because the depolarization at this neural end plate right here is massive. Right? It always is going to reach the threshold voltage for voltage-gated channels that are in the sarcolemma right here. So that's something that's very different compared to a neuron, right? Because neurons can transmit an action potential or not depending on whether a graded potential reaches threshold or not. But every single time an action potential reaches this neuromuscular junction, it is supra-threshold. So a skeletal muscle, these skeletal muscle fibers are always going to contract. And is that a good thing? That's a really good thing, because if I needed a sip of water and I told my arm and hand to pick up this glass of water and take a sip, right? If it wasn't that way, the skeletal muscles could say, nope, I don't want to do that. All right? That really wouldn't work very well for us. All right, so skeletal muscles can never make up their own mind if they're healthy, whether they're going to contract or not. All right, there are different size motor units in different parts of the body. All right, so when a motor neuron is activated, all the muscle fibers in that motor unit contract. The number of muscle fibers in a motor unit varies according to the degree of fine control capability of a particular muscle. And we define that to be the innervation ratio, right, which is the number of motor neurons to the number of muscle fibers. Right, and usually the number of motor neurons is 1, and the number of muscle fibers can vary from 100 to thousands of muscle fibers. All right, so tell me a part of your body that has fine motor control, which means that the innervation ratio is actually pretty large. Okay, like on your face, your fingers. Okay, if you can remember that little homuncular diagram from anatomy and relate that to the surface area of the primary motor cortex, right? That means that you have fine control. You have many motor units going to those places of your body. But for other places in your body that don't need fine motor control, right, then you have many muscle fibers connected up to one motor neuron. Give me an example of some place in your body where that is. You probably did this experiment in lab. Yeah, legs maybe, okay, but one notable place would be your back, which contains mostly just postural muscles, right? You can't write with your back, you can't communicate with your back. I mean, it's just there supporting your trunk pretty much, right? Okay. All right, and when a muscle fiber, like we said, when a muscle fiber gets stimulated, it contracts, and it contracts pretty much in an all-or-none response. And you might say, well, that's kind of interesting, but how is it that when I pick something up, say with my biceps brachii, how come I can generate different amounts of force with that particular muscle if every time I stimulate a muscle fiber, it contracts with its complete ability to contract? Okay, how come I can pick up like a 200-pound weight with my biceps brachii, all right, if I put my mind to it, or I can gently pick up this very light water bottle right here, all right, which condition would I need to generate more force, when I lift up the heavy weight or the light water bottle? The heavy weight. And if I use the same amount of contractile force to lift up this water bottle as the 200-pound weight, what would happen to this water bottle? Well, yeah, I would poke my eye out or go flying across the room or something like that. So muscle contraction is graded. So the conundrum that you have to be able to explain is, if a muscle fiber contracts with an all or none response, how is it that a muscle can produce graded contractions? And the answer to that is to know something about motor units. Not all motor units that go to a muscle are excited at the same time. So if you need a weak contraction, maybe only one or two motor units are activated, and you only get a handful of muscle fibers that contract. But if you need to lift a maximal amount of weight, then all of the motor units going to that particular muscle become activated, and all of the thousands of muscle fibers in that muscle contract together. All right, and we call that recruitment. And the brain estimates the number of motor units required that are necessary to cause a certain kind of contraction. And maybe you kind of realize that. You've seen that happen in your own life. I think of maybe going out to a restaurant someplace, and everybody at the table asks for water, and you're served water and a big mug, and there's ice in it, and you go to reach that big glass mug and lift it up, and your hand goes, whoa! Lifts it up really, really fast. You almost spill it on yourself. And you realize, that mug is not made out of glass. It's made out of plastic. And you had this misconception of how heavy that glass was, and you over-recruited muscles. And when you're in the process of lifting it, the cerebellum realized that you were out of control and then caught that exercise before you spill the water. So the brain does estimate how much force or tension is necessary before the action is produced. And then the cerebellum keeps track of how your body is actually moving with the help of some receptors in the muscles and tendons, which we're going to talk about probably on Thursday. Those are what we call proprioceptors. Okay, so the brain and the cerebellum then keeps recruiting more motor units until the desired movement is accomplished in a smooth fashion. Right, and more and larger motor units are activated to produce greater and greater strength within a muscle. All right, so become familiar with the concept of a motor unit. Okay, so here we have just a nice illustration of a muscle fiber. What's another name for a muscle fiber? A muscle cell. Right, and here we can see a number of nuclei in there, and these tubes right here are called myofibrils. That's the organelle for contraction. And inside myofibrils, we have myofilaments, right? Okay, here we see the nice sarcolemma that surrounds the muscle fiber. That's the same thing as a plasma membrane. And we see that repeated structure over and over and over again within this muscle fiber. And that repeated structure that we see is what we call this repeated structure over and over again. From this tiny dark line to this one right here, Okay? This is what we call a sarcomere. From here to here is a sarcomere, and then from here to here is a sarcomere. So sarcomeres line up from end to end all the way across from one end of the myofibril to the other. But there's something else that happens. Even the neighboring myofibrils, we see that the sarcomeres are lined up exactly the same way, right? The Z lines match up from myofibril to myofibril. And when we look underneath the microscope, we're going to see that these different bands within a sarcomere line up even from muscle fiber to neighboring muscle fiber. And so you see a nice pattern underneath the microscope. All right, so these myofibrils right here are pretty small. All right, they're about one micrometer or micron. Does anybody know how big a mitochondria is? In length, anyway? It's about 10. All right, so these are even smaller than a mitochondria. But, of course, they're very, very long. Okay, these filaments right here, these myofilaments, have two basic kinds. There's a thick one and a thin one. The thick ones are what we call myosin, and thin ones are what we call actin. All right, so here is a nice illustration. Well, we've got a micrograph up over here and then a nice illustration. Let's look at this illustration first of a sarcomere. All right, and the tiny dark lines we call the Z disk because it's really a three-dimensional plate. It's not just a line, right? Because remember, a myofibril is circular if we look at it on end. So this forms a nice disk right here, and then we got another Z disk over here. This defines a sarcomere. So a sarcomere begins and ends at each one of these Z disks. And we really want to understand what's happening within the sarcomere because the sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of contraction. All right, so if you understand how a sarcomere works, you're really going to understand pretty much everything about muscle contraction. All right, so we see some filaments. Let's look at some filaments. This thick filament that's in the middle of the sarcomere is the myosin, and the thin ones that are on the edges and attached to the Z-disc, these are the actin. All right, so we got myosin and actin, and what do we call these things? These are both myofilaments. Yeah, these are both myofilaments. Okay, and since the myosin is a big, thick kind of protein, it blocks light. So it forms this kind of dark band whenever we look underneath a microscope. And that dark band is what we call the A band. So from tip of myosin to tip of myosin, that is the A band because of the way that it interacts with light. Okay. And on the other hand, if we look at the end of a myosin over to a Z disk and then go into the next neighboring sarcomere, right, we see that there is no myosin right here, so light has a very easy job of passing through the tissue at this point right here, so this looks like a very light band. All right, so the A band is dark and the I band is very light, which makes it really easy to remember. Because what vowel do you have in light? I. And does that correspond to the I band in the sarcomere? It sure does, right? So that's really easy to remember. Same thing for dark, right? The vowel is A, and so that's what we have, the A band right here. That's not how it was named, but that's an easy way to remember it. Okay. Within, so we see in some parts of the sarcomere, there's overlap between actin and myosin, right, within the A band. At other parts within the A band, there is no overlap between actin and myosin, which makes this kind of an intermediate shading, and we call that the H zone. Right, so you can see the H zone right here. It's certainly not dark enough to be like these areas of overlap between actin and myosin, right? But not as light as the I band. Okay. The last thing about a sarcomere, well, there's actually two other things. One thing that I can see on this diagram right here is that there is an additional protein that kind of holds the myosin right in place in the middle of the sarcomere. And so sometimes we call this the M line, and I can see the M line right here due to these proteins that help stabilize the myosin molecule. All right. So here is another pretty good illustration of a sarcomere, okay, where we can see the different bands. So make sure you know the different bands, but remember that this is really a three-dimensional structure. This is really a tube. This completely fills up a myofibril. All right, so here is that tube. And if we look at it on edge, let's look at it on the edge over here, so we can see this micrograph right here. So here is a myofibril, and right where I have the cursor, what kind of protein is this right here, right at the tip of the cursor? Is that big enough for you to see? Myosin. How did you know that was a myosin? Oop, I moved it. Because it's thick, right? The diameter is relatively large. All right, and what kind of protein is right at the tip of the cursor right here? That's an actin because it's thin, right? Okay. And which one of these two proteins is attached to the end of a sarcomere, the Z-disc? Is it the actin or the myosin? It's the actin, right? Okay. The other interesting thing about this particular slide is if we look at a myosin myofilament right here, it is completely surrounded by something. What's its nearest neighbor? What do you see? What's next to it? There's a myofilament that completely surrounds every myosin filament. It is? Here's myosin, and what's next to it? Right there. What's that? What's that? Say it first, quick, before I move. An actin. So surrounding every myosin filament or myofilament are actin myofilaments. And surrounding every actin myofilament are myosin, right? So they surround each other because there's going to be a special interaction that we're going to look at between these different myofilaments. Okay. All right, so here is, I'm sure this is an exam figure. This shows the complete story of, well, almost a complete story of the sarcomere. All right, so we got the thick filament or myosin, the thin or actin. The thin is attached to the Z disc. The only other structure that I haven't talked about yet is this thing that looks like a spring right here. And that's a chitin filament. That's a protein as well. And that's a very important kind of protein. It helps stabilize the myosin so it doesn't move around within the sarcomere. But it gives another important feature to muscle in the following sense. Okay, if I want to lift my hand up, if I want to flex my elbow, okay, so give me an example. What kind of muscle am I using to flex my forearm like that? Biceps brachii, okay? But the biceps brachii can't really do its job unless something else happens. There's something else that's pulling on my arm, especially at the olecranon process right here. What's attached to the olecranon process? All right, yeah, somebody said the triceps brachii. All right, so in order for the biceps to shorten, what has to happen to the triceps? It's actually got to stretch out, right? So that's another important property of skeletal muscle. It is elastic, right? Not only is it excitable, it can contract, but it also is elastic, which means that when tension is released from it, it goes back to its original location. So skeletal muscle can contract. It is extensible, it can stretch, and then when the stretching force is released from the muscle, it goes back to its original location because of this chitin filament right here. But the chitin does not really cause the muscle to shorten. It just makes the muscle to go back from a stretched condition to what? A relaxed resting state. It can't cause the muscle to contract. So it's not an active protein for contraction. It just maintains a normal resting state of a muscle. Okay. All right, so how does a muscle contract? So good question is, if we look at that, what's the structural and functional unit of contraction again in a muscle? It's a sarcomere. So we see a number of proteins. And what's the function of muscle to? The function of muscle is to contract. So we see a number of proteins right here. So a real basic question would be, when a muscle contracts, which ones of these proteins actually contract or shorten? Okay, so let's take a look at that. Who maybe would say myosin shortens? Nobody. Who would say actin shortens? Nobody. All right. Yeah, I know, I'm trying to trick you. But you guys are waking up, that's good. Okay, because actually when a sarcomere shortens, right? The Z discs come closer together, but that's not because any of these proteins actually get shorter, all right? And the way that we describe that is with the sliding filament theory of contraction. And when we say theory, what does that mean? Educated guess? Or proven hypothesis. It's a proven hypothesis, right? So I'm not making any of this up. Okay, so muscles contract because myofibrils get shorter. But what's the building block of a myofibril? What lines up from end to end to end within that organelle? You got a Z-disc and then another Z-disc and another Z-disc. What's in between the Z-discs? The sarcomeres, right? Okay, so myofibrils get shorter because each one of those individual sarcomeres get shorter. And that's because the thin filaments slide over in between the thick filaments. That's what we call the sliding filament theory of contraction. And when those filaments slide over each other, the distance between the Z-discs gets shorter, and that pulls on the whole myofibril, and all of the myofibrils within the muscle fiber contract, right? And then the whole muscle eventually contracts because it's all connected together with connective tissue, right? The connective tissue sheets. All right, so there are a lot of Nobel Prizes awarded to people that were able to figure this mechanism out just by looking at these photographs right here, okay? And so when a muscle is at rest, we can see this band right here. What do we call this band right here? Okay. Is it dark or light? Light. And so that's the I band, right? And then we got this band right here. Which band is this? Okay, this is the dark band, right, or the A band. All right, so when muscle starts to contract, look what happens. This I band goes away, all right, and the dark band pretty much stays the same width. All right, and based on this H band right here, right, where there's no overlap between actin and myosin, disappears as well. Okay, and on that basis, all right, they were able to figure out or then show how a sarcomere actually contracts. All right, so here we see a muscle when it's at rest, right? It's a relatively long sarcomere, and as it contracts under this condition right here, notice that the I band starts to go away, and we see that over here. The A band is what? The same length, right? And we see that over here. Can you see that the length of this myosin filament is the same in case one and case number two. And look at the length of myosin in case number three when the muscle is completely contracted. It's the same length. And look at the length of actin from here to here is the same length from here to here. And even in the third case when the muscle is contracted, actin is the same length. But what about the sarcomere? It gets shorter and shorter as what happens? As the actin and myosin slide over each other. All right, so actin and myosin don't change their length, right? But the distance from Z disc to Z disc does change as the filaments slide over each other. Another pretty good model would be if we have these two markers right here, and the ends of the markers represent where the Z discs are going to be. How could we get the Z discs to come closer together? All right? And look what's happening. Are these my hands are a lot closer together, but what about the markers? Are they any shorter? No, they just slid past each other. Okay, so that's the same thing what happens for actin and myosin. So none of the proteins actually get shorter. Okay, so I don't want to go over this slide. I want to talk about that slide in terms of, and use some of these illustrations right here. All right, so we need to zoom in to appreciate some finer details of actin and myosin. All right, so what do we got right here? This green thing? All right, that's the thick filament or myosin. And we can see that it has some processes sticking off of it. We call these head groups. All right, myosin heads. And here is the actin molecule. And you can see that an actin molecule has some components associated with it too. It's not a long fiber. It's made up of hundreds of these globular proteins. Sometimes we call this a G-actin, meaning that it's a globular kind of protein that have been strung together to form a myofilament. But that's not the only protein that we see in an actin molecule. It also has something called tropomyosin, which is a long filamentous protein, and a couple other globular proteins called troponin. And troponin is a very similar or cousin molecule to calmodulin. Who can tell me something about calmodulin? It likes to bind calcium. That's right. And when calmodulin binds calcium, what happens? What's the big deal with that? Yeah, it can activate or inactivate other enzymes, changing the metabolic activity or the physiology with inside of a cell, okay, when it becomes activated as a result of a calcium signal. Okay, so troponin is going to be, you're going to see, is similar to calmodulin. It's going to interact with a calcium ion. Okay. All right, so what else can we say about this particular molecule right here? So this head group has a number of different components. All right, it has an ATP binding site right here. What good is ATP? Energy source, right? It's an energy source. It has an actin binding site right on the top of the head group. And what does that mean? Actin binding site means that under proper conditions, it can go ahead and bind to an actin molecule. All right, I don't see it bound at this particular time. All right, and then attached to the head group is this myosin tail. And this right here is what we call a cross bridge. This, and a cross bridge means that it can go across from myosin and attach itself to this actin molecule. Notice that there are two conformations to this cross bridge. It can be in this bent conformation or it can be in this linear conformation right here. All right, so this area right here can act like an articulation, maybe like an elbow or something, flexing and extending, right at this joint, right here. Okay, and that's going to cause sliding of filaments past each other. All right, so ATP is going to be the energy source for changing this conformation, and under certain conditions, the head can bind to an actin protein right here. Right? And what happens when ATP turns into ADP and inorganic phosphate? Which one has more free energy? Does ATP have more free energy or does ADP and inorganic phosphate have more energy? ATP has more free energy, right? Okay. So when ATP is hydrolyzed, that releases energy and can cause a conformation change in this cross bridge right here. All right, so that's why there has to be an ATP binding site. All right, so let's look at what actually happens. Okay, under the proper conditions, which we're going to look at in a couple slides, when the actin binding site binds to the myosin binding site on actin, should I say that one more time? The actin binding site is on the myosin head group. It can bind to the myosin binding site on this G-actin molecule. All right, so it's associated. And when inorganic phosphate is released from the ATP binding site, all right, that's going to change a conformation in this cross bridge right here to where it's going to articulate. Right? And we call that the power stroke. That happens when inorganic phosphate is released. Right? So it's going to go from a connected position to actin. All right? When PI is released, then that cross bridge is going to like flex. Think of like flexing at the elbow. Can you see that now the cross bridge has flexed? And when it does, it moves the actin, okay, to the right. When it does that. So that's what we call the power stroke. When the cross bridge goes from a linear conformation to a bent conformation. That's what we call the power stroke. And what causes the power stroke? What causes the power stroke? Due to the release of inorganic phosphate. All right. So you all know that when we change the structure of something, that can induce conformation changes. And when you induce conformation changes, that's going to change how things function inside the cell. All right, so PI release is going to cause this power stroke. And then actin and myosin are going to slide over each other. All right, so here is a more complete picture of how actin and myosin slide over each other. All right, in a resting case, right? the cross bridge is not attached to Acton. And we have ADP and inorganic phosphate right here on the myosin group. So here's the myosin head. All right, when the proper signal is given to the muscle, then this head group can attach to the actin molecule. So here we see now case number two. Right, myosin is attached to actin, and we have both ADP and inorganic phosphate. And when inorganic phosphate is released, what happens? The head group goes from a linear conformation to a bent conformation, and when that happens, that slides the actin molecule to the right. Right, so PI is released after the head group is the myosin head group attaches to actin. Right, when PI is released, that causes the power stroke, so it goes from a linear to a bent conformation. And as the head group is bending, ADP is released. So here ADP is released. So now we have a unoccupied ATP binding site. So guess what can move in here? ATP can now bind to the ATP binding site. And when it does, that twists and turns the head group. It changes another little conformation in the myosin. And when ATP binds, look what happens. What's the difference between this illustration here and this one here? Well, we see ATP is bound to the ATP binding site, but there's another important distinction that happens. What's another difference between picture number four and picture number five right here? The myosin head group releases itself from the actin molecule. All right, so what is necessary? Another question I could ask is, what is necessary to break the cross bridge to cause the release of myosin from actin? It is ATP. But the hydrolysis of ATP? Or what? You're shaking your head no. I like that answer. I don't see ATP being hydrolyzed or broken down. I just see what? The binding of ATP to the ATP binding site on the myosin head causes the release from actin right here. Okay. And then, when ATP binds to this binding site, it's released from actin. The binding site contains an ATPase, which means what? It's an enzyme. ASE is an enzyme, which works on what kind of substrate? ATPase works on what kind of substrate? ATP. It hydrolyzes ATP, and when ATP is hydrolyzed, what's the result? A lot of free energy is released that can be used to do some kind of work, like doing what kind of work is being done right here. This myosin cross bridge goes from a bent conformation to a straight conformation when ATP is hydrolyzed. All right? And so this now stores that energy of ATP into the straight conformation of this cross bridge. We say it's like cocking the cross bridge when ATP is hydrolyzed. All right, and then after ATP is hydrolyzed, what can happen? It can attach back to the actin, and when PI is released, right, the linear conformation changes to the bent conformation that causes the sliding of the filament. ADP is released. When ATP binds, then the myosin head group releases from the actin, and the whole process can start over and over and over again. And for every cycle, right, the actin slides to the right as a result of that. Okay. All right, so what can you tell me about ATP? Tell me something about ATP. If you're a living person, how much ATP do you have? Lots of ATP. All right, as a matter of fact, if you were going to try to find out if a cell is alive or not, you could just look and see if it has ATP. If it doesn't have ATP, what could you tell me about that cell? It's dead. Okay. All right. And at least from TV and motion pictures and things like that, or maybe general education, when somebody dies, okay, what conditions do their muscles eventually go to? Are they loose and flaccid? They what happens to muscles? They actually contract and become very hard. What do we call that? Rigor mortis, right? So when somebody's dead, right, their muscles become contracted and very, very hard. Now, how is that? What happens there? Okay, because what do you need for muscle contraction? What's the energy molecule for muscle contraction that we just looked at? You need ATP, all right? But now, how is it when a body is in rigor mortis, muscles contract when there is no ATP present? All right, that's kind of a conundrum. How do you think of that? In viewing this mechanism right here, can we explain rigor mortis according to this mechanism? And it's actually pretty easy to do, okay? Because what is ATP necessary for? Not for the power stroke. What's necessary for the power stroke? Inorganic phosphate release, okay? And then what does ATP cause? The detachment. So if there is no ATP in that muscle, hence when you're post-mortem, there's no ATP, what happens to actin and myosin? They're stuck together because there's no ATP to cause release, right? So rigor mortis can be explained very elegantly in terms of this model right here. All right, so those are some of the key features, right? ATP causes the release, hydrolysis causes the conformation change, right? And PI release causes the power stroke. All right, so make sure you can kind of go around and around in a circle on this one right here. And so what do we call this process right here? Cross-bridge formation, cross-bridge cycling, but the filaments are sliding over each other. We call that the sliding filament mechanism, okay? All right, so we see ATP is necessary, all right, but there's something else that's necessary. Let's talk about the control, how muscles are controlled in terms of the sliding of the myofilaments, all right? We saw how cross bridges are formed. Okay, and in order to do that, we need to look at even finer detail of this molecule right here. And what the heck are we looking at? What have we talked about so far? I don't want to know about the details, but just the overall, what do you call this structure right here? That is a myofilament. How many kinds of myofilaments do you know about? Two, you know the actin and myosin. So which one is this? This is the actin. Yeah, so here's an actin myofilament. And you can see the G actins right here, the globular actin molecules. You can see the tropomyosin, and you can even see a troponin complex right here. And so these all interact with each other. Okay, so these are the building blocks of the actin myofilament. Now, how can you remember this? Well, this big, long filament right here is this big, long name, tropomyosin, all right? This smaller molecule right here is a smaller name, troponin, all right? And it's troponin that is going to be, you're going to see, is similar to calmodulin, which means that it's going to interact with calcium somehow, okay? Well, I tell you what, let me go back to this slide right here. Now, what you can't see on this diagram is the myosin binding site on a G actin because it's hidden. It's covered up by the tropomyosin right here. So underneath this tropomyosin on the G actin is a binding site for myosin. Right? So with this conformation right here, can a myosin bind to an actin molecule? Because there's something in the way. What's in the way? Tropomyosin is in the way. Right, so in order for a cross bridge to form, this tropomyosin has to move out of the way to reveal the underlying myosin binding site on this G protein right here, or the G actin protein. Okay, and what causes the conformation of tropomyosin is calcium. All right, so calcium is going to be released into the myofibril. So here we have a picture of the G actins, right? Tropomyosin and troponin. Here is a calcium binding site on troponin. Here is the myosin binding site underneath the tropomyosin molecule. And we see that this cross bridge is in a linear configuration because it's been charged with the hydrolysis of ATP. How do you know that ATP has been hydrolyzed already? Because we see ADP and inorganic phosphate, right? So now this cross bridge is available to bind to this G-actin right here. But can it? It can't because tropomyosin is in the way. All right, and the way, or the signal that allows for myosin to bind to this G-actin right here is calcium. So when calcium floods through the myofibril, it binds to troponin, right? That's like poking you in the side. That's going to change some kind of conformation in troponin, which is attached to tropomyosin. It moves tropomyosin out of the way, and that reveals the myosin binding site. So now a cross bridge can form. All right, but now what else has happened? We see the cross bridge in a linear configuration here to the bent configuration. What do we call that, going from linear to bent? We call that the power stroke. What produces that power stroke? The release of inorganic phosphate. Okay, so the binding is controlled by this calcium signal. So the only last thing that we have to look at is to see how does this calcium signal get released into the myofibril, right, to reveal these myosin binding sites on the G-actin molecule. Okay. So then what happens if ATP is present? Okay, this ADP is going to be released. ATP will bind, right? If when ATP binds, what happens? Okay, you might have to go back to the previous slide. When ATP binds, then you get release. Right, you get release from the G-actin, and then when ATP is hydrolyzed, this bent conformation goes back to a linear conformation, grabs a G-actin up over in this location, and then with a power stroke, right, it keeps moving over and over and over again, causing the filaments to slide over each other. Now, in the study guide that I gave you a couple really good links that have videos of this, and I don't know if I want to show you the videos in class or not, but I think it'd be really helpful to look them over, okay? Because they're pretty good videos. Okay. So the next thing that we want to talk about is not just the control of how actin and myosin slide over each other, but we want to talk about the whole process of how an action potential in a neuron can actually cause a muscle to contract or to cause a sarcomere to contract. So we got to go back and look at some anatomy. And you're pretty familiar with this diagram right here. So we just see a muscle fiber, and we see a number of nuclei right here. I see striations, and it's a nice long linear fiber. So what kind of muscle fiber does that remind you of? Should be a nice skeletal muscle fiber, right? It's multinucleated. And here's the sarcolemma, which is the plasma membrane of this muscle cell right here. And I see some pits, some holes in the sarcolemma. And these are invaginations of the plasma membrane deep into the muscle fiber cell itself. So these tubes, which are a continuation of the plasma membrane, since they're arranged transversely to the cell, we call these transverse tubules, or more simply, you would like to call them T-tubules, right? They're just called T-tubules. All right. And one similarity of a muscle cell that has in common with the axon of a neuron is that there are voltage-gated channels throughout the whole membrane right here. All right. So that when one area depolarizes, that causes what in the neighboring area of this muscle cell membrane? Depolarization, which causes depolarization in this area. So action potentials can spread over the whole surface of a muscle cell, including, since this is a continuation of the plasma membrane, action potentials then can be transmitted deep into the interior of a muscle fiber cell via what structure? These T-tubules right here. Okay. All right. And the other thing that I notice on this particular slide, that there is a network of membranes inside the muscle fiber cell, and I don't see any ribosomes attached to these membranes right here. So what would you call these membranes right here? Yeah, smooth endoplasmic reticulum, right? If it had ribosomes on it, then its function would be protein synthesis, right? But this is smooth endoplasmic reticulum, which in a muscle fiber cell we call sarcoplasmic reticulum. And this kind of smooth endoplasmic reticulum is not really necessarily lipid synthesis, but the other thing that you memorized, which is calcium storage. So the sarcoplasmic reticulum is loaded with calcium because there are calcium pumps, right, in the sarcoplasmic reticulum that is continuously pumping calcium from the cytosol into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So there's a huge concentration gradient of calcium from the reticulum into the cytosol of these cells right here. And in particularly where we find the greatest calcium concentration are in these terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which you can see is on either side of a T-tubule. All right, so now you should be aware that we have this special electrical event going down through a T-tubule, and it's physically associated with this special reservoir of calcium inside the muscle cell. And what do we need calcium for? That controls the sliding of the filaments, right? Because calcium will bind to troponin. Troponin, when it pulls on tropomyosin, it reveals the binding sites for the myosin head group so that cross bridges can cycle. All right, so please be aware of this diagram right here. So what do we call this area right here of two terminal cisternae with this T-tubule? Anybody remember? Those three little structures right there? Sometimes it's called a triad, okay, from your anatomy. This is called a triad. All right, so the last thing that we're going to be interested in is how does an electrical signal, namely an action potential, cause the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum? All right, so let's zoom in to this area right here. All right, but before we do that, let's take a look at the neuromuscular junction as well as the T-tubule system, and we're going to put it all together. And if you look at the whole theory right here, we call that excitation-contraction coupling. How does excitation, right, when an action potential develops over here underneath the neuromuscular junction, how does that result in contraction? All right, so let's just follow the steps. All right, action potential comes down to this axon terminus, and typically, what do you know about how do we get these synaptic vesicles to move over to this presynaptic membrane to fuse to it and release neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft over here? All right, there's usually a calcium signal, right? There are voltage-gated calcium channels, so calcium enters and then changes the activity, causes fusion and docking of these synaptic vesicles, which then exocytoses neurotransmitter into this cleft right here. And since this is a neuromuscular junction, what's the neurotransmitter that's used? Acetylcholine in 100% of the cases. And it diffuses across the cleft, okay, binds to this receptor. This is a typical nicotinic type receptor, right? So that's a sodium channel. So sodium enters the muscle cell. What happens to the resting membrane potential of the muscle cell when that happens? It depolarizes, right? Okay. Now, right in the periphery, and maybe even in the neuromuscular junction, not only are there ligand-gated channels, there are voltage-gated channels. This is very unlike a dendrite or a cell body, because where is the first place where you would find a voltage-gated channel in a neuron? Is it at the synapse? Oh, it's far away. It's remote to the synapse. It's where? All the way down at the axon hillock, right, or the initial segment of the axon. Not so in a muscle. We have these voltage-gated channels right away. And this neuromuscular junction is huge, and it has numerous ligand-gated channels. So anytime there's an action potential on this neuron, it causes a threshold stimulus to these voltage-gated channels, which then causes an action potential to do what? Sweep over the whole muscle cell, because you have those voltage-gated channels everywhere. So that's a similarity but a difference that a muscle cell has with a neuron. So an action potential moves over the sarcolemma and down into the T-tubule, because what does a T-tubule have? Where do I have the cursor right here? Oh, you guys aren't even colorblind. Hopefully this thing is the same color as that. Is that the same color? Yeah, what is that thing? All right, that's a voltage-gated sodium channel, right? So an action potential here causes an action potential here, which causes an action potential here, right? It flows over the whole sarcolemma and down the T-tubule, all right? And what's associated, what's on either side of a T-tubule? The terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum loaded with calcium, because calcium is being pumped into the sarcoplasmic reticulum all the time. What do you need to pump all that calcium in there? Have you heard of anything like primary active transport? What does that require? ATP, yeah. So there's, it's just an ATP pump that's pumping calcium in all the time. All right. And what does calcium want to do? It's high inside the end of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, low inside the cytosol right here. What does calcium want to do? It wants to rush out down its concentration gradient, but it can't get through the, why can't it get through the membrane right here? Because calcium is hydrophilic and the membrane is hydrophobic, right? So the membrane is a barrier to that particular ion. All right, so, but nonetheless, calcium wants to rush out, but it can't. Well, let's see how it can rush out under certain circumstances. When an action potential comes down this T-tubule, it bumps into this special receptor right here. We call this a DHP receptor, right? And it's a voltage-gated calcium channel. When the membrane potential reaches threshold, this calcium channel opens up, right? Which means what? It physically moves, changes conformation, and it allows some calcium from the extracellular space to enter the cell. That's kind of a minor effect, but nonetheless it does that. Right, so that's different than the sodium voltage-gated channel right here. When it changes conformation, it pulls on another receptor that's embedded in the sarcoplasmic reticulum membrane. Right, and this one right here we call a ryanodine receptor. And the ryanodine receptor is just physically coupled to the DHP receptor. It's not a ligand-gated channel. It's not a voltage-gated channel. It's just a mechanically coupled kind of channel. So when the DHP changes conformation, that causes a conformation in the ryanodine channel right here. That's a calcium channel, and this is a huge one. It's 10 times the diameter of this DHP receptor. All right, so what can you tell me then about calcium when this ryanodine receptor becomes activated? Well, there's a huge rush of calcium out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the cytosol because it's a huge channel. All right, and then calcium can flood this compartment right here and bind to, what is it going to bind to? You could say calmodulin, but you wouldn't be quite correct. You would want to say troponin, and then troponin is going to pull on tropomyosin, get tropomyosin out of the way so myosin can grab onto the G-actin, and as long as there's ATP in the cell, the cross bridges can cycle. It can grab and bend, release, right, extend, grab, flex, right, over and over and over again. Okay. The one last other detail on this particular slide right here, all right, we talked about, of course, these voltage-gated sodium channels that you're familiar with. We talked about the voltage-gated calcium channels, or the DHP receptors right here, and the ryanodine receptors, but the sarcoplasmic reticulum has even another kind of channel in it. And as soon as calcium starts to build up on the outside of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, this third kind of channel opens up, and it's called a calcium-induced calcium release channel. Right, so there is even a third kind of calcium channel that opens up that really floods this whole compartment right here with calcium, and that causes cross-bridge cycling, and then what? Sliding of myofilaments over each other. And when myofilaments slide over each other, what happens to the sarcomere? It gets shorter, right? And that happens through the whole myofibril. All the myofibrils inside that cell contract, and that causes shortening of the muscle. Okay. So here is a little flow diagram that shows excitation-contraction coupling. So you got a somatic motor neuron, all right? And what does somatic motor mean compared to another kind of motor neuron? What's another class of motor neurons that are not somatic? Visceral versus somatic, and maybe I would say visceral in this particular case would be the same as autonomic. right? So when we say somatic, it's going to not a body cavity, but the surface of your body. And somatic also has a meaning of voluntary control, right? Like skeletal muscle. So skeletal muscles are really the only things that you have voluntary control of in your body. Okay, what kinds of motor neurons go to smooth muscle and to cardiac muscle? That would be the, that might be on the task coming up. That would be an autonomic nerve, right? Because cardiac muscle and smooth muscle are under involuntary control, right? So somatic goes to skeletal muscle that causes release of acetylcholine that binds to nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. Where is that at? Where do you have acetylcholine receptors? On the sarcolemma. What part of the sarcolemma has those things? Because what are we talking about? We're talking about some kind of chemical synapse right here. What do we call that chemical synapse? Yeah, neuromuscular junction, the neuromuscular junction that allows sodium to diffuse in, causing a stimulus, right, a depolarizing stimulus, which then produces an action potential, because right there associated with the neuromuscular junction are not just ligand-gated channels, but voltage-gated channels, right, which makes muscle quite a bit different than a neuron, right, and then that action potential gets conducted along the whole sarcolemma because it has voltage-gated channels everywhere, including T-tubules, so action potentials are diverted down to the interior of the cell. And in the transverse tubules, there are these DHP receptors, which allow calcium to enter the cell from the extracellular fluid, but it also does something else. It pulls on the ryanodine receptor on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when it pulls on that receptor, it opens up, and so calcium from inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum can rush inside to the cytosol. Okay, and when calcium concentration begins to increase in the cytosol, that opens up those calcium-induced release channels. So you have this big flood of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum around all of the myofilaments, and then cross-bridge cycling can be initiated because the calcium binds to troponin, it moves tropomyosin out of the way, and it allows the myosin head to bind to the G-actin. All right, so that's what we call excitation-contraction coupling. And one last detail before we go, muscle relaxation is when it happens when there are no action potentials on the sarcolemma. So that means then the release channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum will start to close, and the calcium ATP pumps in the sarcoplasmic reticulum start pumping the calcium out of the cytosol back into the reticulum. And then the calcium signal is removed from troponin. Tropomyosin covers up the binding sites, and so now myosin can't bind to actin anymore. Okay. And then the muscle relaxes as a result of that. All right, so on Thursday, we're going to start right here. Characteristics of contractions. This is kind of more similar to what you've covered in lab so far, I think, some more of the physical characteristics of muscle contraction. I don't think you talk much about excitation-contraction coupling in lab. Probably not. Yeah? Chapter 11. I got a question on chapter 11, which is endo. Okay? Okay. Yeah? Yeah, because aromatic. It has some aromatic compounds. It has an aromatic structure to it. Yeah, because of the aromatic ring structures on thyroxin. It has an overbearing effect that makes it very lipid soluble. I can't. It's lipophilic because it has those benzene type rings on it. Right. Right. Nice question though.